where we will have a program that David Hartman wrote, Scott Guy at Sleeping Dog Productions produced, so a video about the B-17 and our services. So welcome to Warbirds in Review 2017, and please enjoy the program.
Destroy the Arado factory. This plant manufactures aircraft components, principally wing and tail assemblies for the Focke-Wulf 190s. The parts are then shipped to New Brandenburg for assembly. I cannot stress upon you too much the importance of this target. If it is successfully destroyed, it will have a very serious effect on Germany's aircraft production.
Wars have been fought since the beginning of time. As the centuries have passed, the weapons to fight them have become more and more deadly, from clubs and knives to spears, swords and arrows, from flintlocks and lines of men face to face to automatic rifles that shoot fast and far, from little cannons to really big ones that shoot miles. In 1903, the Wright brothers created a game changer, the war game changer, the airplane. Only a dozen years later, Allied and German pilots were flying over the battlefields of Europe, hand-dropping little bombs from their open cockpits. Trench warfare to tactical bombing. In World War I, the Germans even flew 50 bombing raids over England. Airships, Zeppelins, they were easy targets for British guns. But those German raids foreshadowed the Battle of Britain 25 years later in World War II. The British prevailed then too, and it was a turning point in World War II. Billy Mitchell commanded American air combat units in Europe in World War I. After the war, he advocated in Washington for more air power, put money in planes and aircraft carriers, and less in big ships. Air power would be the future. He was totally denied. In fact, he was court-martialed for insubordination and resigned from the air service. After his death, he was exonerated and highly honored. He is the only person to have an aircraft design named after him, the B-25 Mitchell bomber. He is only one of two aviators to have a life-size statue standing in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. The other, recently placed, is of Bob Hoover, the aviator General Jimmy Doolittle called the greatest stick and rudder pilot ever. During the years after World War I, the 1920s and 30s, a big airplane design barreled forward. New planes were capable of flying farther and higher with heavy bomb loads. In World War II, these planes delivered devastating attacks behind enemy lines. More than 12,000 B-17s were built for the war. The Flying Fortress, as it was called, was the workhorse of the European theater, executing precision, daylight, strategic attacks over Germany. With fighter escorts flying from England in giant daytime formations, the 8th Air Force Armada attacked factories and cities, fuel supplies, dams and transportation, crippling Germany's morale and ability to make war. B-17s dropped more bombs in World War II than any other Allied aircraft. But there were great costs, too, especially human costs. 8th Air Force Airmen had more than 49,000 casualties, including 26,000 deaths.
During that particular period, everyone, well, we pretty well realized that we weren't going to make it. Only about one out of four ever made it. If you got over 10 missions, you were living on borrowed time. And everybody realized that.
Our fighter group would be three squadron. One would be maybe a high, one would be one side or another side. And I saw one case where a plane got hit and banged over into adjacent plane, and the two planes go down. And we were always supposed to see, if we saw a plane go down, say, how many chutes did you see come out? So we'd watch. But this place, the two planes went down and no chutes came out. And there's 22 guys were going, no chutes coming out. I'd sit off on them and wonder how in the heck did they get those guys go through that time after time again. How did they get those fellows to do that?
B-17 crews were a major force in destroying Nazi Germany's plan to take over Europe. All who love and respect freedom owe those men a debt of gratitude for committing their lives to protecting our freedoms.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm David Hartman. Please welcome our guests this morning, Ray Fowler, Charlie Valera, and Steve Snyder. Ray Fowler, on your far right, is a lieutenant colonel in the Alabama Guard. He's flown four tours in F-16s, three in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. And he is also a guy who flies every one of these airplanes that has a motor and wings. And Ray is also the president of the Liberty Foundation. Charlie Valera has written a book that's a bestseller these days. It's called My Father's War. And Steve has written a book called Shot Down, Howard Snyder and B-17 Susan Ruth. So we'll talk about all of this now. Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Ray, start us off. This airplane, Madras, I know that Connie mentioned it just a moment about Madras, Oregon. But who is Jack Erickson, a pioneer guy in aviation?
He's an amazing guy. Jack was supposed to be here today. Obviously, he would have been far more exciting to talk to than myself. Jack is part of the Erickson Collection. I say part of it. He is the Erickson Collection. So he's Aviation Hall of Fame. Unbelievable pioneer in the Erickson Skycrane helicopter, if you're familiar with that. I mean, that goes way back, and they pretty much have their hands in everything in aviation, but obviously a huge custodian of aviation with his collection. He has everything from, you know, the P-38 fighters, like 22 flying aircraft, and he acquired this aircraft several years ago, and fortunately I had the opportunity to deliver it to him, and we formed a partnership with the Liberty Foundation, and this airplane has never toured, so the Liberty Foundation's charter is obviously to take the airplane to the public. It's not really easy to get to Madras, Oregon, so it's kind of great to be able to take the airplanes out of Madras and to take them on the road, which we're doing this year, and we're going to add other aircraft and hopefully come to hometowns with this one. And again, since no one's really seen it and had an opportunity to ride in it, I mean, a lot of people rode in the other touring aircraft. Now they can go get in this airplane and go take a flight.
Great. We might also mention that Jack Erickson is big in firefighting. I mean, what they have done in pioneering ways to fight fires, and goodness knows we have a lot of them these days out west especially.
I had an amazing tour. They're just starting to firefight with the Mad Dogs, so the MD-82s, and they did all the engineering for the release out of those aircraft, so, and they've just got their certification. So now they're starting to sunset some of the older PV2 airplanes you see that have fought for so many years for fighting fires in the West, and they're obviously more jets, and they can get there quicker, and they have a little more, and that's all Jack Erickson and his group of engineers that put that together. It's amazing.
Well, Ray, that every one of these airplanes, the names always have, a meaning, a historical meaning. How historical is the meaning of Madras Maven, Maiden?
It's important Maven to Madras, really. So this airplane, a lot of people might have seen it previous life as Chucky. So it flew as Chucky for 30-plus years with Doc Hospers. Once Doc Hospers passed on, it was acquired by Jerry Yagan with the Military Aviation Museum, and he had it for several years and flew it as Chucky, and then ultimately ended up going to Erickson as Chucky. So they were looking for an airplane to honor all the veterans of Madras. And so Madras was a very big training base for B-17. Mm-hmm. So unlike a lot of the airplanes that are painted up as a historical scheme that actually flew in World War II, this airplane is really more of a tribute to all the veterans from Madras that flew there. And it's a great name, and they came up with the nose art themselves and the paint for Madras. And again, we do want people to go to Madras. It's worth the trip if you get to take a trip out there just to go into their museum. You'll see airplanes you'll never see anywhere else, their latest being an ME-109 that just flew. And again, they're just continually adding airplanes, and their charter is to fly airplanes, which is great. So it's cool to see them sitting in a museum, not to fly, but to go out there and watch them fly is really a lot more special as well.
How challenging is it to take these airplanes that were built in this case, 1940s, and not only restore them but maintain them so they are flyable in a safe way day after day? How challenging is that?
The challenge is really the financial end of it. Obviously it takes a lot of money. So everybody always asks, what's it take to keep a B-17 flying? We say a lot of money. Just in gas alone, we budget for 200 gallons an hour. So when you pull up to the pumps, that leaves a mark in your wallet. But and that's part of the Liberty Foundation as well. I mean, it really, it's all about honoring the veterans, and it's keeping the airplanes flying. So, there's a different component of the owners that own the airplanes, and they bring them to the public versus some of the museums like the Liberty Foundation that tries to share it with the public and put people on board and let them to take a flight experience in the airplane and make it affordable. Not everybody can afford to go fly in a B-17. But, again, when we see the kids come up and they know more about B-17s than we do, and we see it a lot, I'm always humbled when a young kid comes up and tells me something I don't know about a B-17 after flying one for 20-plus years. And we know that history's staying alive, and it's just, being a small part of that is amazing.
Try to compare for us. You fly F-16s all the time and have for a long time. What's it like to climb out of an F-16 and then climb into this airplane and fly it? What are the extra challenges?
Well, the biggest thing I would say challenge-wise is these airplanes are really stick and rudder airplanes, and I think this is something that is kind of a lost art in the newer airplanes that are more automated. They take care of you more. So the F-16, you're really not flying that airplane. The computer's flying it. You're really focused on the mission and the avionics and doing what it was designed to do, whereas this airplane, you're flying it all the time, So, again, for all pilots, and I know most people here even today are pilots, if you haven't flown a tail dragger, you need to go out. I've run across people that have thousands, tens of thousands of hours. They've never been in a tailwheel airplane. So you get in this airplane with a tailwheel, it will make you a better pilot to go fly a Cub or to go fly any airplane that does that. And certain flight schools I've run across, they're starting kids in a tailwheel for the first 6, 8, 10 hours of their flying instruction. I think that's unbelievably important because, the tricycle gear airplanes, and particularly the bigger and the jets, they take care of you. You can get away with a lot in those airplanes. You can really have a poor technique in landing, and the airplane's still going to go straight. These airplanes are doing everything they can to not go straight. So it really does help to do that. Whereas the F-16, I've said it for years, I could solo you in an F-16 much quicker than I could solo you in a B-17 or a tailwheel airplane because, again, that airplane, when it lands, it wants to go straight as an arrow. It's very easy to fly, and they want it easy to fly. They don't want me to have to focus on the basic aircraft control whenever I'm out pulling around trying to find a target and shoot something. So, but this airplane, again, there's no automation to help you. Just the simple stuff of putting the gear down to land. Most World War II airplanes, they don't have all the nice bells and whistles to tell you you didn't put the gear down, whereas, every modern airplane will be screaming at you all the way till you touch down. So it's the bigger and newer is typically easier to fly than these airplanes.
What are the avionics in this airplane? To what extent do they maybe, put new glass stuff in there and so on?
Some of them are very modern. This one obviously has a GPS. We fly it all over the country, so the panel's very, you know, fairly authentic. But we do add a GPS, and of course everybody looks at that and they always ask, you know, well, that wasn't there in World War II. And of course the joke is that, yeah, it was black and white display back then, and they have to think about that for a second or two. But World War II would have been over a lot quicker had we had a GPS in there, because you don't miss. You find where you're going. And other than that, this one's fairly authentic. Some of the other airplanes I fly are very modern, you know, with glass. And again, that's for safety. But a lot of people want to keep them authentic. And I fly some that are very authentic. And, of course, then we cheat. We have our iPads and our iPhones and that's how we cheat and find out where we're going. So, it makes you lazy, obviously. A GPS makes you lazy for navigation. But other than that, they're fairly authentic. Everything else is.
Charlie, Ray just mentioned veterans. Why did you write your book, My Father's War? Why?
We're losing a lot of these guys, and we need to get their stories. So when my father passed away, we never got any stories. I have three brothers. There's four of us. And
your father flew?
My father was part of a support group in the 8th Army during World War II. And when he passed away, we just never got any stories. And then long after he was gone, 15 years later, I found out he was in Europe for 3 years, and he was all over Europe. He was in Normandy, Rome, Po Valley, Sicily. And it's too bad he didn't share the stories. So as a result, I thought, you know, we really need to find... Somebody needs to sit down with these guys and get as many of their stories. What was their life like? What was the day-to-day? Did they really march behind a tank? What were these guys like that were flying these, or the ball turret gunners? How about the guys that got shot down, and did they survive? And what was it like? So, you know, the day-to-day stuff. And that was why I really wrote the book, because I wanted the research to find out for their children in all of our families. I'm sure everybody out here has got a connection to them, as we were talking inside. And that was really the reason why I spent 3 years interviewing World War II veterans.
3 years?
Yeah, it was about 3 years.
How many of you in the audience know somebody or somebody in your family who fought in World War II, but you rarely, if ever, heard any stories about what they did when they were in the war? How many?
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. That's...
Yeah.
That's why I did this. You know, there's
there it is.
80-90% of the people
so
sitting
what,
here.
So what were some of these most compelling stories you heard? And how many different types of folks did you talk to?
Well, you know, I try to really paint it with a broad brush. So I have from both theaters. But, of course, being a pilot, I'm drawn a little bit to the B-17 captain, as well as there's another guy that was a Cub pilot that did reconnaissance. So I had both ends of that spectrum. And then there was a dive bomber and turret gunners, but the stories were all the day-to-day stuff that they didn't talk about. Again, as you and I were saying inside, B-17, one of the engines catches on fire. He's at 30,000 feet. He's got to put the fire out, and we know how to do it as pilots, but to try to explain it to somebody that it isn't, you know, he's got to slip it down, keep that wing up, keep that engine getting as much air. He went from 30,000 feet down to 10,000 feet. But that's just one of the many stories. And these things really happened. It's not, to us, it was a black and white clip. And we look at it and watch it and go, oh, geez, wow, that must have been tough. These guys really did march behind tanks, sleep in the snow, sleep in the mud, liberated concentration camps. It's just the most incredible atrocities that people have done. And they've fought to prevent this from taking us over. I just find it amazing.
When you sat down with each of these people, once they agreed to talk with mm-hmm. you, what were their attitudes about talking to you? How reticent were they to talk with you?
Yeah.
How pleased were they?
That's a good question, because at first, every interview was probably conducted over 5 or 6 times, and I did it with a video camera. Most of the time, I asked them, do you mind if I run a camera? Because I don't want to write down what I think I heard you say. So this way here, it was all firsthand, not what I'm hearing. And at first, many of them were kind of standoffish. They didn't know me. I didn't know these guys. You know, that I just knew that they were in World War II, and I tried to explain, well, my dad was there, but I didn't get any stories. And there's a lot of people like me today whose fathers or grandfathers or uncles were in World War II and didn't give any stories. Would you mind sharing them with us, with the readers? And so after a while, they opened, but I'll tell you, it took me 6 or 7 attempts to sit with them. And of course, nobody talks in chronological order. So then I got to find out, well, were you in France at that point, or were you in Italy? And, I mean, the stories were just incredible.
Can you recall any that were really compelling for you? And
yeah.
How often did you get emotional, if at all, listening to this?
It wasn't, for me, it wasn't as emotional as it was. I was astounded. I was amazed at, you know, one of the guys talks about liberating a concentration camps. And they didn't, he was what, part of Patton's Third Army, and they were supposed to go into Berlin, and as we know it, how it all changed out. So on his way in, they headed south. He ended up at Buchenwald and helped liberate that concentration camp. And they were just, they hadn't seen anything like it. There were bodies there that had just been shot. And the Nazis that shot him left. They were about 20 minutes ahead of him. That was it. And they just couldn't believe that they pulled these people out just to hurry up and shoot them to try to get rid of the evidence. So there's stories that are, there's so many of those that it was emotional for them when they were telling me, and I was a little concerned.
It was.
Oh, very, very, very emotional for them, yeah. There were times when guys would just look outside the window, and one guy, I remember him saying, he was a ball turret gun, I remember him saying to me, I don't know how we survived. I don't know how any of us survived. And there was another guy that knew, used to fly with Jimmy Stewart. And I don't know, I said, did you get his autograph? I know. He laughs. He says, autograph? We were supposed to die the next day. We didn't think of it. We just wanted to go out and drink because tomorrow wasn't going to happen. That was it. And it like you were saying, right, it was just one day. It was one day at a time, and one day, 1 hour.
So besides pilots and a turret guy here and there, a troop there, what are some of these other stories that you particularly remember from your book?
You know, there was one about this guy that was he was with two other soldiers, and they were out trying to find some booze. And he'd run across a nun and a little kid, and they were in France. And the little girl says to this guy that spoke a little bit of French, he said that there are Germans in a building over there. And they hadn't met the enemy before. So they split up, the three guys, the three American soldiers, and he threw a grenade at the door, and the door opened up, and out came a white flag. And so some Germans came out. Turned out there were 30 of them, and they were all armed. But what we don't
know... Now, this is what year? This is in 44?
45. 44, yeah. Okay. What we didn't know, and we'll never know, is how long were they stuck inside that barn? Could have been weeks, months, who knows? But there was, they all came out with guns, and Fern Frechette, who I'm referring to, literally had to take the machine gun from the first guy out. He still has that machine gun.
So they indeed surrendered.
They did. Yeah, 30 against 3, though. And then they said, Fern, go get the rest of the troops. Now, he's got to get in the Jeep. He said his knees were shaking, his legs, he was so scared. He's never been so scared in his life. You know, he's 19 years old. He's got a machine gun. He doesn't know what he's doing. This is crazy stuff. And he drives back to get the troops. He's so scared, he barely knows where he's going. And his, you know, his legs are, and these other two guys have to stand there with 30 soldiers, POWs, and keep them together. It's just those kinds of stories that were true, that really happened, and these are the guys that did. You can't have enough of respect for some of these soldiers.
Did those, to your knowledge, did those German soldiers ever say why they were so, you know, outnumbered, the three Americans? They sounds like they figured they were safer, you know, surrendering to our guys than they might have been if they'd, I don't know.
Yeah.
What did they tell you?
He didn't. They just put him with other POWs.
Yeah.
Our discussions were how long were they in there. So if they were scared and stuck in that barn for 2 weeks with no food or water, that was not uncommon. And so they could have been easily stuck in that building for a long time without coming out. Maybe, you know, for one reason or another, they didn't want to fight anymore. And they would, a lot of them would just like us. They didn't want to fight. They didn't want to do this. This wasn't of their background, you know, and now all of a sudden you're soldiers and you need to.
And they were just as young as our troops.
Yes. Right? Yeah. And maybe a lot more battle-hardened because they had started a lot sooner than us, as we know. They, you know, they had 8 or 10 years on us. It's really a remarkable collection of stories that I think we all need to know about. And
how much did you learn in the process of researching this and doing these interviews? I used to mention the word chronological earlier. Think about the war mm-hmm. and how it progressed. How knowledgeable have you become about the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month operation of World War II in Europe?
Considerable, to the point that it's funny because what I may be doing, I have a forum that I'm doing here, and I'll probably do a bombing run mission that I can do because I've heard it, I've seen it, I talked to the guy that has been in it, and so I know the whole mission. And there's no way I can tell you how much I've learned, but it's been a three-year research. And because all the stories are so various that I needed to understand, you know, sea rations or explain them to people and what life was really like. You know, did they really sleep in foxholes?
Who was Ernie Pyle? Yeah.
Right. There's a lot written on the on certain soldiers, but there's I don't think a lot written on the spokes in the wheel.
You mentioned a mission. We hear 1,000 B-17s,
mm-hmm.
2,000 B-17s, mm-hmm. 1,000 fighters or more in a single mission.
Right.
And those numbers are inconceivable to us today, Ray.
Oh.
I mean, inconceivable. So what was one of these missions like? Describe one of those missions.
Well, when you have 1,000, when you need to get 1,000 B-17s in the air, they circle, and one bomb group will get together, and then the next, and the next, but they're all circling. So an area like this, I mean, it would fill up a quarter of the state in the year. I mean, it's an enormous amount of darkness up there. And you're climbing at altitudes. So you might start at 3,000, 5,000, till you're up to maybe 25,000 feet. Now the first element of 12 is going to head out over the channel. But part of the things that I found interesting was that 2,900 gallons per plane, with 1,000 planes, is 2.9 million gallons of fuel. And that was just today. They're going to go out and fly again tomorrow and the day after. When 1,000 planes at 10 guys per plane, it's 10,000 airmen and gunners, 10,000. What about the ground crew? What about the food? I mean, the whole logistics of it is amazing. And they did these 1,000-plane bomb runs every day. I mean, for the longest time, it just did what they had to do. And that's another thing they all said, very, very humble. We just did my job. But they all felt as though that one little piece of their job was life or death. You know, whatever it was they were doing, they had to make sure whether they were making parachutes here in the States or whether they were navigating. Everything was that important. Everything was life and death. Job, do your job, you know.
Steve Snyder, shot down, right?
Right.
Howard Snyder and the B-17 Susan Ruth. It's quite a title.
Yeah, well, it's quite a story.
Who's Susan Ruth?
My dad was a B-17 pilot in the 306 bomb group, and he named his plane the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas.
Is she still living?
Yes, she is. And my other sister was born while he was missing in action, so that was real tough on my mother.
Wow. So tell us what your book is and why did you write it?
Okay. Well, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed with the 8th Air Force, flying high-altitude daylight precision bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And his plane was shot down on February 8th of 1944, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture. He finally made it back to England when he met up with Patton's Third Army.
Wait, back up a second. Wait. he was shot down and baited for 7 months?
Yeah.
That's all we're going to hear about
Oh,
God. Wait a minute. So where was he? France, Belgium, Germany?
His plane was shot down right over the French-Belgium border. In fact, the plane and he came down in Belgium, and the rest of his crew that were able to bail out came down in France.
Not far from Dunkirk, but we don't need to go there right now. But anyway, so he shot down near the French-Belgian border.
Right. They were attacked by two German Focke-Wulf fighters after a mission to Frankfurt. They dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They lost airspeed. They fell behind the formation. And these two Focke-Wulf fighters came in and swooped down on them. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the crew members were killed in the plane. The other two, the other eight crewmen were able to bail out. But both those Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he died in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. When I was doing my research, one day my wife asked me, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I thought to myself, well, that's a crazy, ridiculous idea. How am I ever going to do that? But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger.
Where was he?
And he lives in Munich now. He's 93 years old. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks English. And he gave me some incredible and wonderful...
What was that conversation like? Wow.
Well, obviously, I was pretty excited when I found this guy was still living and that he spoke English. It was, I went on the Internet, and I joined a couple of forums, and I posted inquiries because I knew the day my dad's plane was shot down, the place, the time of day. And within a week, two guys got back to me, one from England and one from Belgium. And on that day, there were 10 B-17s that were shot down, and the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, was shot down by Hans Berger. And the guy in Belgium, he was a Luftwaffe historian and written a number of books and knew Hans personally. And so he asked Hans if it was okay for me to contact him, which Hans did. And I, over the phone and through email, we communicated. At first, he was a little hesitant. At one point, he goes, Steve, I don't really know you very well, and you're asking me all these personal questions, because I had so many questions I wanted to ask. But over time, I built up his trust, and we've become good friends.
So get back to your dad on the ground evading. So how did he evade, and who helped in the process?
Okay. Well, he bailed out. It was around a little after noon that his plane was shot down, and he came. He was the last one to parachute out of the plane since he was the first pilot commander of the plane. And he came down in some trees, and his parachute got hung up in the trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgium farmers saw him coming down and came to his rescue. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, and helped him down the trees. But they told him to stay put and hide until it got to be nighttime, because there were German patrols combing all around the area looking for these guys that had bailed out. So they came back that night and then took him to a farmhouse where he just stayed the first night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer. And then they moved him, the Belgium underground moved him from place to place for several months. How long he stayed in any given house depended on how brave the people were that lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might be there one night, he might be there 6 weeks.
But how dangerous was this also for the Belgians who were hiding people like your dad? How endangered were they?
Those Belgian people, my dad couldn't talk enough about them. He saved, they saved his life. If the Gestapo or the Germans found out that Belgians were aiding a downed airman, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the Belgian people that helped my dad and other members of the crew were imprisoned, and some were killed. So they were extremely brave people. My dad said they would let him sleep in their bed, give him the majority of the food. Just unbelievable brave people.
So they moved him around a lot, right?
Yeah, a lot. And, you know, normally when the underground came across the downed airmen, they tried to get him back to England through various escape routes down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out. And I can only imagine how stressful that must have been, because first, you know, here his plane's attacked, shot down, it's on fire, he has to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is.
I mean, just bailing out of an airplane sounds like enough.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, go ahead.
And then he doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew. He has to rely 100% on strangers. He can't speak the language or communicate, except he has a little French-English dictionary that he can refer to. And any one of these people that are helping him could be a collaborator and turn him into the Gestapo. And then when he was hiding out of these houses, the Gestapo could break in at any moment and arrest him and either send him to prison camp or shoot him. And there's a number of instances in the book that are described when he was almost found out. But then after a few months, he finally got tired of hiding. So he decided to join the French resistance and start sabotaging German convoys.
The Maquis?
Yeah, the Maquis. Right.
So what was that experience, especially for a guy who doesn't speak French?
Right. Well, before he went into the Air Force, he was actually in the infantry for a year. So he knew how to fight on the ground, and I think that's one reason he had the courage to do that. And also through information provided through the underground, he knew that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day on June 6th. And so he wanted to get back into the fight, and he was just tired, I think, also of being the hunted and wanted to be the hunter.
By the way, what was the date when he was shot down?
February 8th of 44.
February 44, okay.
And so then he joined up with the French resistance, the Maquis, in July. The people that were hiding him did not want him to do that. They thought it was way too dangerous, because if the Germans caught him, he'd be shot on the spot. But he insisted, and so one of his helpers, they had a couple bicycles. They crossed over from Belgium into France. Then he hooked up with a Maquis unit, which was made up of about 20 guys led by a French lieutenant. And then he harassed the Germans, attacked convoys, and there's a number of stories in the book about them doing so. And it was interesting to note that, well, they got their information from the British over the BBC through coded messages. And my dad said it was amazing how accurate those messages were, because the British had decoded their the German Enigma machine. If they told them that there was going to be a convoy coming down this road at that time, boom, they would be there. It was amazing how accurate they were.
Explain to those who don't know what the Enigma machine was in Britain.
Well, that's how the Germans communicated through coded messages, but the British captured an Enigma machine and decoded it. And they knew every movement the Germans were doing, often before the German officers in the field even found out about their instructions. And then they were supplied by airdrops from the British.
So how long did he stay with the Maquis?
He was with them until February 2nd, 1944. That was the day Belgium was liberated.
44. Ah, sorry.
Yeah. Because Patton's army came up through France after D-Day on June 6th of 44.
Okay.
He was with a Maquis unit, and they had set an ambush for a German convoy, but that day they didn't come by, but he heard that there were some U.S. troops in a little village of Trelon, France. So he hightailed it over there, walked into the town square, introduced himself to an army major, was interrogated, and then he made it back to England and then back to the U.S.
How much of this did he share with you initially, or younger? How old were you when he came back? Oh, you were
luckily, five of my dad's crew made it back alive. Five of them did not. Unfortunately for me, my dad was one of the five, or I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, right. At what point do you recall he started relating any of this to you?
Well, I knew the basics, but like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk about it very much until 1989. There was a memorial erected in Mackinac, Belgium, to my dad and his crew, and he and three other living crew members at the time went over for the dedication. And there he was reunited with many of the Belgian people who hit him during the war, saw those houses where he stayed, and that brought it all back. Wow. And he started talking about it after that. And then in 1994, my wife and I accompanied my parents to Belgium for the 50th anniversary of the liberation of my dad's plane being shot down, where I saw everything firsthand, and that's when it really became personal for me.
How, the Belgians, we hear other stories about the Belgians having great respect for the Americans.
Oh,
and talk to that if you would.
Unbelievable people. I've been to Belgium four times, and to this day, they are still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from Nazi occupation and oppression. And they do a fabulous job of educating the younger generations, too, to remember. They've erected a number of memorials in the area, and on the anniversary of those events, they have ceremonies there. But the big ceremonies are around September 2nd each year, the liberation, where they have several days of celebrations. They erect these big tents and have lunches and dinners and dances and parties, military vehicle parades, and all the local villagers come out, dignitaries, U.S. Air Force is there, Belgium Air Force, French. They're really wonderful events.
So, Charlie, this all rings bells with you, doesn't it, what you're hearing?
It really does. Yeah, absolutely does. It's awesome, too, to hear that, you know, he got out, he had a hide. They just, this is real life stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you were talking about him not really bringing it up until later on in life.
Right.
That's a real common thread. I don't think I could have gotten my interviews done 10 years ago because I don't think they were willing, at least the ones I talked to, weren't willing to talk about it.
Wow.
So you were way ahead of them, and probably because of the 50th anniversary of, you know, the plane being, I mean, being shot down, that he was able to talk to you about it. And I, you know, you were lucky to be able to have that. I don't think most of us had that that honor, I guess, to hear what their lives were really like. And you got firsthand details. Lucky you.
Yeah, another thing I have that's pretty amazing, my dad wrote a diary while he was missing in action of his plane being shot down, which is absolutely riveting, which is in the book. And then my mother had kept all the letters that my dad had written to her during the war.
Wow.
And when I sat down and read those, it was just fascinating. My dad was really candid in what he wrote in those letters. He talked about bombing missions. He talked about what life was like on the base. He talked about what life was like in England and London at the time, talked about escapades of his, of him and his crew. So it was unbelievable information that really formed the backbone for the book. But it goes into detail about what happened to each member of the crew, just not my dad.
How much luck do you think we'd have if we asked Fowler to create details about flying over Iraq and Afghanistan?
I know. We could ask. You think he'll answer?
He could ask.
You try it.
Ray, what when you listen to this about the conducting a war with your experience and you listen to this, what goes through your head?
Well, the biggest thing, those guys told the truth, so any fighter pilot story today is about 10% truth, so we certainly over-embellish our accomplishments to make ourselves look good. You know, the biggest thing, I look at this and the respect of those guys, especially because they had to grow up so fast and they were so young going into combat, and, you know, even now I think a lot of people, you know, they see their 18-year-old drive off in the car and they wonder if they're going to make it back, you know, where these guys went off to war, you know, 17, 18, 19, and just an unbelievable responsibility. I think the big takeaway of today in flying, you know, flying over Iraq and Afghanistan and having the opportunity to do what I've done is the fact that you can take a single airplane and a single bomb and do what and accomplish with that what they sent hundreds of airplanes and thousands of bombs because of the precision. I mean, we just today we don't miss. It's you know, it's an amazing capability to be able to do that. You know, especially now collateral damage being really important not to hurt people that don't need to be hurt. So, you know, that's the biggest takeaway on that. Obviously, the B-17 had the Norden bomb site, which gave the precision bombing, and, you know, most people know about the Norden bomb site. Very guarded secret of World War II, and it did the math. So it just, you know, from my standpoint of doing manual bombing in an F-16, which the computers are doing all the math when we still practice manual bombing because there's a utility, we may do that, but most of the time we're doing everything GPS-guided munitions these days. But the fact that they could drop a bomb from, you know, the high 20,000, low 30,000 foot range, and that bomb could land anywhere even close to where they planned for it to hit, is that's amazing in itself. However, you did have to drop, you know, sometimes thousands of bombs to, you know, to accomplish the objective for that mission, to knock out the factory and to really slow the war effort for the enemy. So, you know, that's my takeaway again. And we're relatively protected now. I mean, it's I've had some very exciting adrenaline filled missions in combat, but for the most part, we're very protective. We fly above the threat. You know, we run around in an air-conditioned cockpit, which is pretty nice. Whereas
around in the F-16 cockpit.
We run around, yes.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
So it's just, you know, I can't imagine going out and, like, we're talking about the numbers of 1 in 4, like with Hal Weekly at the start of your program, talking about how 1 in 4 aircraft with 10 men may not come back, you know, and you just wonder if this is your day. You know, I think today we don't go into the air thinking we're going to lose. It's a totally different landscape. And, you know, hats off for those guys to wake up every day and not just that, but to lie about their age so they can get in to go die for our freedoms. And that's what they did every day. Everybody was part of the war effort. So, you know, it is a different footprint these days from, you know, you wouldn't see anyone protesting in World War II about anything. I mean, they're trying to get in and do their part, you know, for all of us. And again, and you still see that very patriotic today for the young people that are signing up and enlisting to go fly and fight. But I tell you what, I'll take an F-16 in my odds in that airplane today than I would a B-17 or even the P-51 of those guys. It's just it's amazing. I'm amazed when they jump out that they're able to even get found and make it back, you know, and all the resources, like you're saying, to come get them. So at least now when I land, they know where I'm at with a satellite looking at me, which is pretty nice.
And what you said about age, it's still the case that it's kids out there on the ground.
It is.
Now as then.
Well, it has to be kids, because when you get older like myself, and of course I'm towards the tail end of my career, I still get to go fly, but, you know, once you get older, you start saying, gosh, this is not you need the ignorance to go fight wars so you can say, this is, I can do this. You get a little older and wiser, you think, you know, maybe that's not the smartest thing to do. But no, it's, again, no matter what happens in the world, you know, there's always going to be someone else that is going to step up to defy us. And, you know, there's got to be young people that you know, are ready, you know, ready to defend us. And, man, hats off to everybody that's ever served, you know, and being involved with the World War II airplanes, fortunately, because of Ed and Connie, which started this program, I got to start flying World War II airplanes before I was ever in the service. So, again, I got to fly running cool airplanes, and that really compelled me to go sign up and go serve. And programs like this, obviously, see airplanes fly over, go to air shows. That's what gets them to sign up and go do the same thing. And, you know, everything that you do and this program does, it helps the effort all the way across.
After we finished our conversation, ladies and gentlemen, Connie Boland's going to be here, Ray will be here, the gentleman will be here. If you'd like to ask questions from the stands of them about the airplanes, they'd be delighted to hear your questions. So, and then one last one to you, Ray. And now, oh, you knew how to fly when you went to Air Force training. What was the reaction from your instructors when they found out that you already knew how to fly?
Well, I was well briefed to not tell anybody I knew how to fly. So make no mistake, even though I was flying P-51s and B-17s, even when I went to pilot training, I went with a little over 3,000 hours of flying time. I went in and didn't say a word. So they're there to teach you how to fly, and create a little bit more issues for yourself if you go in and you think you're ace of the base, especially for the new guy that just came back as a first-time instructor. You know, so they're there to hammer you and but they obviously knew I had some experience. I was very lucky, and then, of course, they would ask me what I flew, and, of course, I downplayed it. I fly Cessnas, and you know, and which worked out real well. And, of course, towards the end of the flight training, I gave one of our instructors a ride in a P-51 right at the end of pilot training, so they were like, okay, we get it. So, again, nice. It's an amazing experience to go through the military training and to really see it from the other side. Again, this morning we got to go fly, and to step out of a World War II airplane and go step in a modern airplane, right. It's a nice, enviable position to be in.
Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Ray Fowler, Charlie Valera, Steve Snyder. Thank you, gentlemen. And Connie Boland. There's Connie Boland.
There's Connie Boland.
You're on.
Thank you, all of you guys. So we'll open it up to questions here in a few minutes. Ray, you want to step over to this big bird here and maybe tell us a little bit about the missions and tell me how much fuel does it I told him I was going to ask him a hard question that he couldn't answer, but I don't think that's possible with Ray. He's been flying them so long. Tell me about your scariest moments, how much fuel range. Tell me something that the crowd wants to hear.
Specifically about B-17, right? So today we have 1,700 gallons of gas on the airplane, so you can go a long ways. Combat, they had an additional 1,000 gallons they could put on, so very, very long-range airplane, of course. And today this airplane is, again, almost exactly like it would be in World War II. You know, the engines are identical to what they flew in World War II. And, gosh, I don't know what to tell you other than the fact if you've flown a Piper Cub, this is a 4-engine Piper Cub. It's very easy to fly. It'll embarrass you. You can bounce it down the runway a few times, which I've done quite often, but very easy to fly.
We can get current in one landing, right?
One landing.
You get three in one.
Which I have done.
And Ray has been known to fly with a girl every now and then, so that's a pretty scary moment in a B-17, right?
That I have. And, in fact, Connie flies. We've been flying P-51s together up here, but we also get to go fly the B-17. And I put her on the spot. She had not flown one for how long had you flown before? It had been several years, I guess.
It had been several years.
So I put her on the spot, made her land in front of thousands of people at an air show, and she did a far better job than I did after not touching it for a while. So
he was such a good guy. He was sitting in the right seat on that particular occasion. He said, "Now don't mess this up." You know, the Blue Angels were at this air show, but the funny part of that, he had kept the rental car keys in his pocket, and we had gone to another airport just to test fly this B-17, and as it turns out, we found out he had the keys in his pocket, and they said, yeah, go ahead and come back, and you can land. The FAA guy comes out to the airplanes. We don't shut the B-17 down. We threw the keys out to the FAA guy, and we took off again.
I do that a lot, so thanks to FedEx.
As we're riding along.
That was an expensive way to do it.
Yeah, it's like, okay, go back and fly this B-17. So it's been a lot of fun. I have to tell you that Ray does fly everything out there, and the F-16, his service to the country in Iraq, Afghanistan, and what the Alabama Guard does with their Red Tail program. They have a scholarship program in Montgomery, Alabama. I'm really, really proud of that unit there. This is not for me, though, Ray. Tell me something.
Well, I'll tell you really about the quick plug with the Liberty Foundation. So a lot of people are familiar with the Greenland Expedition, where they went in the ice and brought the P-38. So the founder of the Liberty Foundation, Don Brooks, his father was a tail gunner in the B-17, and he had passed on years ago, but he wanted an airplane as a tribute to his father. He restored the Liberty Bell. So if you guys heard of the B-17 Liberty Bell, we had a fire in 2011. Landed in the field successfully. Everybody got off the plane, and the fire trucks weren't able to put the fire out until the airplane was fairly consumed. So we're rebuilding that airplane and a second airplane down in Douglas, Georgia, which is why we're so happy that the Erickson Collection was able to give us this airplane and let us take it around the country. But again, libertyfoundation.org is a great place to go look. I mean, obviously, we want people to come out and go fly with us, people that have money. Don Brooks is an amazing person. You know Don, obviously, and just inducted in the Georgia Aviation Hall of Fame. Actually invented the golfer that went down in the ice to pull the airplanes out. So he makes me sound like a northerner, actually, with his accent. He's down in South Georgia, but just incredibly bright, and came up with that concept to bring the airplane. He was actually there to bring the B-17s out. There's still three B-17s down in the ice, 275 feet in the ice. But they were completely crushed. They were 4 feet tall. So the P-38 did come up, and it flies today. It's one of the most authentic P-38s. It is the most authentic P-38 as far as original airplanes, since I think they had less than 20 hours on them when they went, ended up on the ice cap in Greenland. But that's why Don does what he does as a tribute to his father and all the veterans. And, again, this airplane, we don't give rides here at Oshkosh, but we do out on the road. And it goes to Erie, Ohio, on this weekend to go fly. In fact, I see my driver, John Shuttleworth, is flying the airplane out tomorrow. He's another accomplished Warbird pilot and flies everything as well. And they'll take the airplane out and just find a schedule, come fly with us, and be involved. That's what we ask. We love volunteers. Like she said, this all survives off of volunteers, and people want to donate their time and talent to keep these airplanes going and keep programs like this going. And thank you, Connie, for everything you've done. I wouldn't be flying these airplanes if it wasn't for Connie Boland, and that is an honest truth. Of why I'm able to do what I do.
Thank you, Thank you, Ray. Yeah, I'll take all the credit. You know, he was marginal, and we brought him along best we could.
Still marginal.
Still marginal. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask of any of our panel here? Yes, sir.
What's the oil consumption on? You told us a little bit about the fuel consumption. How about the oil consumption? How much oil does each engine have?
Each engine has 37 gallons behind each, and really the entire per engine is about 40. So about 160 gallons of oil behind the radial. About a gallon an hour per engine, so that's a high consumption rate. Really, we're about a half a gallon of oil. So if you see a radial engine start, everybody always sees all the smoke coming out. So you sometimes throw, you know, about a half a gallon of oil out of the engine when you just start it, depending on how long it's sat. So, again, one of the radial engines are incredibly reliable. They're not efficient, and they're heavy. So one of the reasons the newer engines today, believe it or not, are less reliable. They're still very reliable than the radials. But this thing, you pull up, and obviously sometimes you top the oil and check the fuel because it burns so much oil. But that's a good question. You definitely go through a lot of oil in the B-17. And, again, that's another tremendous expense to keep the airplane in the air.
Okay. We have another question.
Yes, Mr. Fowler. I was just curious, how did you get your handle Hollywood?
And I know where was that, because I know I should have said not give him
that,
the mic.
That was
so,
Rod.
Yeah, that's Rod. Well, it's a tactical call sign, and usually when you ask any fighter pilot how they got their call sign, they won't tell you, and I'm not going to tell you. So I could have ended up with worse. So, once you have become mission ready as a fighter pilot, you go through a naming ceremony. It's an evening affair. It's one of those things, is not a good deal for the person being named, but it's a lot of fun for everybody else. And once you, if you like your call sign, once you drop a bomb or you serve in combat, you get to keep it forever. So I figured I could have done worse, and I've gone to combat, so I'm not going to get renamed anytime soon. But it has nothing to do with Top Gun, thank goodness. Not a good story.
I don't think he's going to tell us. That's okay. Do we have another question?
Wait. I've got a question as far as what the protocol was for the non-pilots, the guys in the crew, to get out of that airplane. When the time in those heavy, fast accelerating airplanes, you had just probably 30 seconds. I don't know. You had no time. You had to make that decision, get out of the airplane. And why didn't they go to the barnstormers and learn how to skydive? I've never been able to quite figure that out.
Exactly. Well, I think protocol, and these guys could probably even answer more to that, but aircraft commander would make the decisions once they're going to jump out of the airplane. So your pilot, your co-pilot, and your navigators were all officers on the plane. And then once the airplane was not flyable, you know, the command at some point was made to bail out. What's interesting, of course, they call it the Flying Fortress, and we all know it's Flying Fortress because of all the 50 caliber guns all over the aircraft. Everybody asks about the ball turret down here. Well, the ball turret was statistically the safest part of the airplane. It really was. You had to be the smallest guy on the crew, and that's usually how they pick the ball turret to get in there. And I've actually stuffed myself in that ball turret, if you can believe that, but in fit. But once they made that decision to bail out, again, some of the stories about the guys in the back would be waiting for the guy to come out of the ball turret to give him his parachute. They couldn't even wear the parachute in the ball turret. So there are stories where those guys rode airplanes to their deaths waiting for their, you know, for their crew member to come out of that ball turret to give them a parachute to jump out. So, aircraft commander made that. And if you guys want to add anything else to that, just because you might know a little more stories about how about your dad? Who made that call as far as when jumped out?
Their intercom system, I don't know if this is on, their intercom system was knocked out. You know, he was yelling them at him to bail and hit the bell to bail, but he didn't know what happened to the guys in the back because the plane was on fire. The guys in the nose, is the navigator, bombardier, and flight engineer, he saw them. Knew they bailed out, but he didn't know anything about the guys in the back.
A good cue is when you see your pilots jump out, that's probably a good cue to leave, I would think.
It's like follow me, right?
Exactly.
A quick story. We were on tour with the B-17. EAA's airplane had a veteran come up to the airplane, and he said, "Do you mind if I lie down under your airplane?" And we said, "Well, of course not." And so he does. I mean, he wanted to go back, and I mean, he just thought it would be cool to go up once again and see. He said, "I just wanted to."